On this edition of Celebrating Science, Simon Singh on the Big Bang. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, non-profit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Big Bang, Simon Singh explores the history of cosmology. He is a documentary filmmaker with a PhD from Cambridge and CERN. He is also the author of three popular books specializing in mathematics and physics.
Thank you very, very much for inviting me back here to speak on behalf of, in association with the Perimeter Institute. It's a real pleasure to talk to such a knowledgeable audience. I know you have so many events here and you cover so many subjects, many of them cosmological. But what I'm going to do is kind of take a step back from that. About 3 years ago, I decided to write a book about the Big Bang. That's when I came up with the title. It just struck me as short and punchy, snappy, memorable. The only problem was that exactly the same time as my book, Big Bang, was published, another book was published with exactly the same title. So here's my version of Big Bang. The other book was Big Bang, the Only Sex Manual You'll Ever Need. I only mention this in case there are people here under a misapprehension because you're going to be really disappointed by the end. You've heard many speakers talking about some very complex issues in cosmology and some of the great challenges facing cosmologists today. What I wanted to do in my book was to take a step back and just celebrate the fact that we have a theory of the universe and its history and its origins. For thousands of years, we've wondered where the universe came from. Now we have a compelling, beautiful, elegant, reasonable, rational, verifiable theory of the universe. And I wanted to explain what the Big Bang theory is, who came up with the idea, and why we believe in it. I'm going to start the story in 1930. In 1930, Sir James Jeans, a very eminent British astrophysicist, wrote a book. His book was called The Mysterious Universe. And that was his attempt, 75 years ago, to explain to the public what cosmologists at that time understood about the universe. It was a very popular success, not just in Britain, but also on this side of the Atlantic. The Hollywood screen goddess, Tallulah Bankhead, even she read this book. She was so impressed, she said it contained what every girl should know. So, clearly a popular account, but it described a very different universe from the one we think about today. Sir James Jeans's universe was eternal and static. It had been here forever, and it was going to stay here forever. Whereas the Big Bang theory, which we'll come to in a second, says the universe hasn't been here forever. It was created. It was created a finite time ago in a very different state, and it's evolved from that state into the universe we have today, and it carries on evolving into the future. So two very different views of the universe. If we go back 75 years, everybody believed in the eternal universe. So the first question is, where did the Big Bang theory come from? Well, it was pioneered by a chap called Georges Lemaître, a Belgian cosmologist. And he simply said that according to the laws of physics, it was possible that the universe started off hot, dense, and compact. It exploded outwards. The debris formed galaxies, and the galaxies continue to fly apart, if his theory is correct. Essentially, he was proposing the Big Bang model. He didn't call it Big Bang. He talked about a day without a yesterday. But essentially, this is the Big Bang model. He didn't know if it was true or false. He just knew it was compatible with the laws of physics. But immediately, everybody rejected it. People said, look, we like the old theory. Because if the universe has been here forever, we don't need to worry about when it was created, how it was created, or who created it. And the who created it is important because, as you can see, Lemaître was a priest as well as a cosmologist. And so people looked at Lemaître and they said, look, the reason you want creation is because creation implies a creator. And you're just trying to smuggle God into physics when no one's looking. He said, no. He said, there are two ways of arriving at the truth, and I decided to follow them both. By that, he meant he was religious, but he used religion to explore the spiritual world. He was a scientist, and he used science to explore the material world. And he didn't mix the two. He didn't back up his faith using science, and he didn't back up his science using the Bible. So he believed in the Big Bang Theory because he thought it was good science, but still nobody believed him. Even Albert Einstein, when Einstein heard about the Big Bang model from Lemaître himself, Einstein immediately responded by saying, your calculations are correct, but your physics is abominable. Now, this is an important point because what Einstein's saying is that what you have is some theoretical calculations. Now, theory is one thing, but the question is, does your hypothesis match reality? Do your mathematical equations relate to genuine experiments and genuine measurements? If your theory doesn't match reality, then your theory could be rubbish. And this is a very important point. If you don't check your mathematics, you can come up with all sorts of nonsense. And just to show you what I mean about this, I'm going to show you a theory that I've been developing using some quite complex mathematics. And according to my theory, the Teletubbies are evil. Okay? The Teletubbies, I think most of you know, are a BBC TV series. And the Teletubbies are a product of time and money. The BBC put a lot of time and money into the Teletubbies. We know that time is money, so we can substitute back into the first equation. Money times money is money squared. I can introduce at this point a new axiom, which is that money is the root of all evil. So therefore, money squared is evil, and therefore the Teletubbies are evil, okay? So, it's only a theory. It's only a theory. The important point is if I wanted to prove that this was true, I'd have to do an experiment. And here's a scientist doing an experiment on a Teletubby, and they are indeed evil. So if Lemaître was going to prove his theory, he needed to do an experiment. He needed to check his maths by looking at reality. And in astronomy, what you tend to do is make observations, and the key observations were made at Mount Wilson Observatory in Southern California, home to the biggest and best telescopes between about 1910 and 1940. They had the 100-inch telescope, a giant 100-inch telescope, probably wouldn't have fitted into this room. And as well as having the best telescopes, they had the best astronomers. This is Edwin Hubble. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the Hubble Space Telescope. Well, it's named after Edwin Hubble because he was such a brilliant astronomer. Not just a great intellect, but also very charismatic, very charming. People would travel all the way up to Mount Wilson, one, to look at these beautiful machines, but two, to meet the great celebrity Hubble. And in fact, his future wife met Hubble on one of these trips. She traveled to the mountaintop. When she got to the mountaintop, she saw Hubble in the distance, and he was looking at a photograph of a galaxy he'd taken the previous night. And when she saw him standing there, she never forgot that moment. She described him as an Olympian, tall, strong, and beautiful, with the shoulders of the Hermes of Praxiteles. There was a sense of power channeled and directed in an adventure that had nothing to do with personal ambition. So she was clearly smitten. Unfortunately, she was married at the time. She was married to a geologist. Now, being married to a geologist isn't very pleasant. But 3 weeks later, her husband was on a field trip. He fell down a mine shaft and he was killed. So there's a happy ending there of sorts. So what did Hubble do that helped Lemaître? Well, Hubble was interested in galaxies. So here's a galaxy, 100 billion stars maybe, swirling round. And we know the universe is full of these galaxies. Each of these smudges is a galaxy, billions of galaxies. And each of these smudges, as I say, contains maybe 100 billion stars. Now, we know that each of these galaxies is rotating, like a Catherine wheel. But the question that Hubble wanted to address is, what do these galaxies do relative to each other? Do they move randomly? Do they move systematically? Maybe they don't move at all. Maybe they just float there in space, doing nothing. So that was the question that Hubble wanted to answer. What are the dynamics of the cosmos? So how would you ever measure the motion of a galaxy? Well, all you'll ever get from a galaxy is light. So just to remind you, light is a wave. If it's a short wave, we call that blue or violet. If it's a long wave, we call that red. And that's kind of all you need to know about light. And what you need to know about a galaxy is that the galaxies are made of very particular elements, all the elements we find here on Earth, carbon and sodium and iron and hydrogen. And the elements give off very particular wavelengths. So we know what color sodium gives off. Sodium gives off an orange color, which is a wavelength of 589 nanometers. Sodium gives off that color here on Earth, so sodium should also give off that color in a galaxy. We should see that wavelength. We know sodium always gives off this color. That's why sodium lamps, street lamps, are always orange. Also, if you electrocute a gherkin, which I can do for you here. So this is a gherkin. It's pickled in salt. So salt is sodium chloride. And because there's sodium in this gherkin, when I pass a high current through it, that should excite the sodium atoms, and it should give off that classic orange color, 589 nanometers, because that's what sodium atoms always do. Now, I should stress here, you mustn't try this at home, okay? This really is not very safe. Actually, let me try this one here. So this is, I've got two forks here, upturned. They're connected to the mains. Here's my gherkin. And if we can dim the lights a little bit. And as I say, when the mains go through the gherkin, you should see an orange glow. Here we go. There we go. So that's not red hot. It's not white hot. It's gone straight to that classic sodium orange, same orange you'll get from a sodium street lamp or from a galaxy, because that's what sodium always is smoking rather more than it ought to. Let me just stop that there. So we know sodium should give off 589 nanometers. And Hubble expected that when he looked at a galaxy, he would see that wavelength and other wavelengths associated with other elements. But when he looked at the galaxy, that's not what he saw. The reason for this goes back to work done by Christian Doppler. Christian Doppler was interested in waves, not just light waves, but sound waves. And I'll explain kind of the Doppler effect using sound. I've got a beeper here. If I switch on the beeper, it gives off sound. So it sends out sound waves symmetrically all around the room. Sound is a wave. If it's a long wavelength, that's a low pitch. If it's a short wavelength, it's a high pitch. And whatever that pitch is, it's symmetrical. So what we have here is a representation of that. It's as though I'm tapping the surface of a pond and sending out ripples, and it doesn't matter which side of the pond you are, each microphone hears the same sound because the sound's generated symmetrically. But look at what happens when that object starts to move. Now the object's moving to the right. So as it moves to the right, the waves on this side get squashed. So this microphone's going to hear a short wavelength or a high pitch. This microphone's going to hear a longer wavelength or a low pitch. So now, even if you can't see that object, if it sounds lower than it should, it must be moving away from you. If it sounds higher than it should, it must be coming towards you. And that's known as the Doppler shift. And if I spin this around my head, you should be able to hear the Doppler shift. As it comes towards you, you'll get a high pitch. As it moves away from you, you'll get a low pitch. And if we can just dip my microphone, then you'll hear this directly. Here we go. Hands up if you can hear that. Oh, great. I can't hear it because I'm in the middle. I'm in the middle, so it's not coming towards me or away from me, so I don't hear the variation in pitch, but it sounded as though everybody in the audience could. Now, exactly the same effect happens for light. So here's a galaxy. The galaxy's moving away from me, so the waves are being stretched. So that galaxy will look redder than it should, because long wavelength is red at the top. If the galaxy is coming towards me, then the wavelengths get squashed. Short wavelength, that's blue, that galaxy is going to look bluer than it should. So instead of emitting that perfect orange, it'll either give off a reddy orange or a bluey orange, depending on the galaxy's direction of motion. The amount of redness or the amount of blueness tells me the amount of velocity and the direction. So this is really crucial for what comes next. Redshift and blue shift, direction of motion of galaxies, color changes, velocities. This is really important for what comes next. So what did Hubble see? Well, these are three galaxies he looked at. He looked at the first galaxy. It was 9 billion kilometers away, and it was moving away at a speed of 6 billion kilometers a year because it was slightly redshifted. So it was moving away, and that's why I've got a negative sign here. The second one, it was further away, but it was moving away faster because it was even redder. The third one was even redder still. It was moving away even faster still. 730 billion kilometers a year. To put that number into context, if a plane could travel that fast, it would go around the world in just a few seconds. So these are phenomenal speeds. But it's not the speed that's important. What's important is the fact that all of these galaxies are redshifted. All of the galaxies are moving away. Now, this is exactly what you would expect if the universe started with a Big Bang. Hot, dense, compact object explodes outwards, the debris forms galaxies, and the galaxies are flying apart. Whenever Hubble looked at a distant galaxy, it was always flying apart. It was always redshifted. So this is the very, very first evidence we have to back up the Big Bang theory. So let me just summarize where we are. 1927, Georges Lemaître comes up with the Big Bang theory. 1929, that's when Hubble comes up with this evidence that I've just shown you, that everything's redshifted, therefore everything's moving away, therefore that's compatible with the Big Bang theory. But in 1930, we started the talk by looking at Sir James Jeans in his book, The Mysterious Universe. In his book, he didn't mention the Big Bang. So how can that be the case? We've got a good theory, some good evidence, and yet Sir James Jeans is ignoring it and not talking about the Big Bang. In fact, the whole scientific establishment is ignoring the Big Bang. So why is that the case? Why can science ignore something in the face of good theories and some good evidence? Scientists are only human too. And scientists have biases and expectations and prejudices. And so when scientists look at data, especially if it's bad data, and remember Hubble's data, Hubble was looking at the most distant objects then known, measuring tiny, tiny shifts in color. So his data was up for interpretation. So people who didn't believe in the Big Bang, and remember, nearly everybody didn't believe in the Big Bang, would interpret Hubble's data to fulfill their expectation that it still didn't prove the Big Bang. Remember, all the professors didn't believe in the Big Bang. The establishment didn't believe in the Big Bang. The textbooks didn't believe in the Big Bang. Einstein didn't believe in the Big Bang. So people would look at the data and interpret it to fill that prejudice. So as they continued not to have to believe in the Big Bang. So one example of this is a chap called Fritz Zwicky, a very grumpy astrophysicist. My favorite thing about Fritz Zwicky is that if he didn't like you, he had a very good insult. His insult was to call you a spherical bastard. By this he meant a sphere is a geometrical object which looks the same whichever way you look at it. A spherical bastard is someone who's a bastard whichever way you look at them. So, he didn't believe in the Big Bang. He didn't believe in the Big Bang. And people would come up to him and say, but look, the galaxies look red. They look red because they're moving apart. That's because of the Big Bang. He said, no, nothing's moving. Well, how come these galaxies look red? The reason they look red is that they're not moving. The galaxies emit light. The light gets scattered by dust and gas. When light gets scattered, it loses energy. When light loses energy, it looks a little bit red. Okay? So nothing's moving, light's emitted, light gets scattered, light loses energy, light goes red. He called it the tired light hypothesis. And it's actually good physics. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different way to interpret the same data. It's an interpretation that fits his bias, which is against the Big Bang. But in terms of physics, there's nothing wrong with it. So you have a situation whereby people who didn't like the Big Bang theory could continue to ignore the Big Bang theory because the data was open to interpretation and they could interpret it to fit their bias, which was to be against the Big Bang theory. Now, eventually, Zwicky's data was... His hypothesis was undermined, because when you make really careful observations, it turns out that you really can't disagree with the fact that galaxies really are flying apart. There's just no two ways about it. But still, people were biased against the Big Bang. So they came up with other excuses to interpret the data, so it still didn't have to believe in the Big Bang. And so, for example, this is a picture of Thomas Gold, Herman Bondi, and Fred Hoyle. All three of them hated the Big Bang. And they came up with another hypothesis called the steady state theory, which allowed for the galaxies to expand, for the universe to expand, for the galaxies to move away, but which didn't imply the Big Bang theory. Now, this is kind of difficult to imagine because on the one hand, the galaxies are moving apart. On the one hand, the universe is expanding, it's changing. On the other hand, they imagined that the universe was eternal. It had just kind of been here forever. Now, if something's been here forever, it tends not to change. It just tends to be the same forever and ever and ever. But the universe is changing. It's getting bigger. It's expanding. So how can something change but stay the same? That was their problem. Eternity we kind of associate with similarity. But expansion we clearly associate with change. So if you acknowledge that the universe is expanding, how can you have a universe that changes but stays the same? That was the problem they faced if they wanted to continue to rebel against the Big Bang theory. And they came up with the following hypothesis called the steady state theory. I'll tell you about the steady state theory in a second, but first of all, I'll tell you how they were inspired to think of it. Remember, their problem is the universe changes but stays the same. How can that possibly be? Well, they went to see a film. They went to see a film called Dead of Night. And it's quite a famous film in Britain because it was released after the war. It was the first horror film to be released after the war. And you couldn't make horror films during the war. It was just bad for morale and they were all banned. But as soon as the war finished, this is the first horror film that was made, Dead of Night. So Thomas Gold, Herman Bondi, and Fred Hoyle went to see this film. And if I tell you the story of the film, you'll see why it inspired their steady state theory. The story is about a young man who's fast asleep. He's having this dream. In the middle of this dream, he suddenly wakes up. He realizes he's late. He gets washed. He gets dressed. He jumps into his car. He drives into the countryside. His car breaks down. He goes into a house looking for help. In the house, he finds lots of people. And he says, "This is really weird. I've never seen any of you before. But I know you because you were in a dream I just had last night." And everyone in the house is a bit spooked by this, so intrigued about this stranger who claims to have met them in a dream the previous night. But because they're intrigued, they start telling him their weird stories. So every guest in the house tells the visitor about a strange experience. When they finish telling him their weird stories towards the end of the film, they all get up and they walk towards the chap at the door whose car is broken down, and they grab him by the neck. And they begin to strangle him. And just as they're about to throttle him to death, he wakes up. He realizes he's late. He gets washed, he gets dressed, he jumps into his car, he drives into the countryside, his car breaks down, he goes into a house, the house is full of strangers. Says, "This is really weird, I've never seen any of you before, I remember you from a dream I just had last night." So here is a film that clearly changes because it's got plot development, but it kind of stays the same. Here's a film that clearly changes, but it could go on forever and ever and ever. And it was that film that inspired Gold, Bondi, and Hoyle to try and think of theories of the universe, whereby the universe changes, but kind of stays the same. And this theory was the steady state theory. And this is kind of how they explain the expansion of the universe. First of all, just to remind you, the Big Bang Theory, each of these dots represents a galaxy, the universe is expanding, and the galaxies are just moving apart. So the universe is getting bigger and emptier and more desolate. And if you run the clock backwards, you run it back to a point of infinite density with all the galaxies, all the matter squashed into a single point. In the steady state universe, you have a different scenario. What Gold, Bondi, and Hoyle suggested is that the galaxies move apart, but in between the galaxies, new matter is being created. So you have baby galaxies being formed. As the galaxies move further apart, the matter accumulates, so the baby galaxies become grown-up galaxies. And this looks pretty much the same as this. Okay, this is bigger than this, but if the universe is infinite, twice infinity is still infinity. So nothing really changes. The overall density of the universe is still pretty much the same, as opposed to here, where the universe gets more and more empty. This is clearly evolving. This maybe isn't evolving. And this one, you can't trace it back to a beginning, because if you trace this back far enough, it starts off as a baby universe in between two other galaxies. So this universe doesn't have a beginning, and it doesn't really change in the same radical way that the Big Bang universe does. And that's the problem. Cosmology is divided. By 1950, you have two views of the universe. You have the steady state theory, championed largely by Fred Hoyle, which says the universe has been here forever and it doesn't really change. And you have the Big Bang theory, championed by Georges Lemaître, which says the universe has a finite age and it's expanded and evolved rapidly into the universe we have today. And cosmologists are divided. Nobody really knows which theory's right and which one's wrong. And cosmologists make up their minds according to all sorts of strange and bizarre reasons. I'm sure Georges Lemaître partly liked the Big Bang Theory because it was his idea. Some people liked the Big Bang Theory because it reminded them of Genesis. Some people didn't like the Big Bang Theory because it reminded them of Genesis. Some people liked the steady state theory because the notion of eternity was philosophically attractive. People made up their minds due to aesthetic, religious, philosophical reasons. Science had very little to do with it because there wasn't much scientific data. People made up their minds according to prejudices and biases and all sorts of strange reasons. And that's how science works. But it only works like that when you don't have data. Scientists, in fact, hate this situation. Scientists hate this situation where they don't have the hard data to say who is right and who is wrong. Because what good science is about is getting the hard data that decides whether it's a Big Bang theory that's right or whether it's a steady state theory that's right. If you get good data, if you make better observations with better telescopes or do better experiments, eventually that hard data will tell you which theory is correct. It doesn't matter what your bias is, what your prejudice is, what your expectation is. The hard data will tell you the right answer. There's no more room for interpretation. And that's what good science is all about. In fact, what's happened over the last 30 years is as that data has come in, over and over again, that data has vindicated the Big Bang model. And over again, it's the steady state theory that's lost out. And in a way, that's what I like about science. Fred Hoyle, for example, Fred Hoyle is a wonderful chap, a brilliant cosmologist, one of the greatest cosmologists of the 20th century, a real genius. But in this case, he was utterly wrong. But that's one of the things about science. It doesn't matter if you're smart, sometimes you're wrong. He was also Sir Fred Hoyle, he was very highly respected. But it doesn't matter how respected you are, sometimes you're wrong. His idea was really quite beautiful, and he desperately wanted it to be right. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how beautiful your idea is, it doesn't matter how clever you are, how respected you are, how much you want your idea to be true. If your idea doesn't match reality, you have to get rid of it, you have to reject it. It's reality that tells you the truth, not politics or your political power within an institution or your reputation. It's reality, it's the observations that dictate. My favorite quote in science comes from Huxley, the 19th century British naturalist, Thomas Huxley. He said, "There's nothing more tragic in science than the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact." And that's all this science is. The ugly facts will tell you which theory's right and which one's wrong. And I just want to finish by just describing one of those facts that really helped win the argument for the Big Bang supporters. This goes back to 1948, when these three gentlemen, this is Robert Herman, George Gamow, and Ralph Alpher, working in Washington in the 1940s. In 1948, they were nuclear scientists, and they made some predictions about the Big Bang theory. They didn't know if the Big Bang theory was right or wrong. They kind of liked the Big Bang theory. But they said, if the Big Bang theory is true, then after the Big Bang event, sometime after the Big Bang, there should be a blast of radiation released. And that radiation should still be here today in the form of microwaves. Okay? So if the Big Bang happened, and we don't know if it did, there should be a blast of radiation. If there was a Big Bang, then that radiation should still be here today in the form of microwaves. Look into space. If you see the microwaves, you know the Big Bang theory is true. If you don't see the microwaves, you know the Big Bang theory is wrong. So this is a make or break test. It's really putting your neck on the line. And that's why this was a really important prediction by Gamow, Alpher, and Herman. The only problem was that in 1948, people didn't have the technology to detect microwaves from outer space. So this prediction was kind of largely forgotten. In 1965, however, some 17 years later, these two gentlemen came along, Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias. They weren't particularly interested in the Big Bang. They didn't really follow the debate with any great intensity because they were radio astronomers. In radio astronomy, what you do is you build a radio telescope like this, and you point it up at a galaxy, and you detect the radio waves from galaxies. Galaxies emit radio waves. If you can detect those radio waves, you can work out what's going on inside the galaxy. But before they pointed their radio telescope at a galaxy, they pointed it away from a galaxy. Because if you point it away from a galaxy, you should get nothing. And that way you can calibrate your detector. So point it at nothing, get nothing, check everything's working properly. The problem was, when they pointed their radio telescope at nothing, they picked up microwaves. Microwaves are a type of radio wave. Now, this was a bit annoying, so they pointed it somewhere else. They got microwaves. They waited 24 hours. They still got microwaves. Wherever, whenever they pointed their telescope, they kept on picking up microwaves. And they had no idea what this was, and they found it very annoying and irritating. They wondered whether the microwaves were coming from inside the telescope. Maybe there was something inside here generating the microwaves. So they looked inside the funnel. Inside the funnel, they found there were two pigeons that were nesting. The pigeons had deposited what they diplomatically call a white dielectric material. So they got a big pigeon trap. They caught the pigeons. They took the pigeons back to their offices about 30 miles away. They released the pigeons. Pigeons being pigeons just flew straight back. They got their pigeon trap. They caught the pigeons again. They shot the pigeons. They cleaned out the white dielectric material. Still, the microwaves kept on coming. They couldn't figure out what was causing these microwaves. Eventually, a colleague tapped them on the shoulder and said, "Look, what you've discovered is the microwave radiation from the Big Bang. What you've discovered was predicted 17 years ago. These microwaves have exactly the right wavelength as you would expect if they came from the Big Bang. The only way to explain these microwaves is if they came from the Big Bang." We believe in dinosaurs today because we see the dinosaur fossils. We believe in the Big Bang because we see this fossil radiation. If you're driving home this evening and you tune your radio in between stations and you hear that hissing sound, 1 or 2% of the energy that your car aerial is picking up is this energy from the Big Bang, this microwave radiation being picked up by your car aerial. This is real compelling evidence that shows that the Big Bang really did happen. That's the pigeon trap they used. If you're ever in Washington, you can go to the Smithsonian Museum and visit it. I'm going to leave some time for questions. I'm going to sort of wrap up here. I started in 1930 with Sir James Jeans, who wrote a book, The Mysterious Universe, and Tallulah Bankhead liked it. I've tried to update the story. I'm nowhere near as eminent as Sir James Jeans, or as smart as him. But I have a shared ambition, which is maybe one day Cameron Diaz will say my book contains what every girl should know. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
The data that came back to Hubble indicated apparently that there was increasing acceleration by galaxies the farther out they were. Did that not disturb them at all in 1929 and afterward?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I wasn't aware of that. Let me go back and have a look at the little bit of data that I've got here. What we can see here is the data that I'm showing sort of suggests that if you double the distance, or you multiply the distance by about 20, you increase the speed by about 20. There's a kind of proportionality. But the numbers are very rough and ready. There are a lot of errors here and so on. Now, you're suggesting that there was evidence here for an acceleration. I've never heard of that. So I'd be surprised, just because this data is full of errors. So, for example, one of the things you can do with this data, and people did it back in 1930, was to work out the age of the universe. If this galaxy is 9 times 10 to the 18 kilometers away, and it's moving at that speed, how long did it take to get that far away? Well, we can just divide 9 by 6, and we get 1.5 billion years. So according to this data, 1.5 billion years ago, that galaxy was back here. According to this data, this galaxy was back here 1.3 billion years ago, this one 1.6 billion years ago. So what this data is telling me is that roughly 1.5 billion years ago, all the matter in the universe was right back here, so maybe that's when the Big Bang happened. Today, we know the Big Bang happened about 14 billion years ago. So this data is inaccurate by a factor of 10, mainly because this distance number is wildly wrong. So I think there were so many errors in Hubble's data, and that's why it was open to interpretation, that I'd be surprised whether people picked up on the acceleration thing. I think the idea of the Big Bang itself was so bizarre that whether it's accelerating or not was even more dubious.
What other evidence is there other than the Doppler shift for the galaxies moving away? Can they see that, or how do they know?
Right, so how do we know what other evidence is there that the galaxies are moving away? As far as I know, there isn't much else. I think that's kind of as compelling as it gets. You see this red shift. It's more complicated than I've suggested, in that the mass of the galaxy will have a gravitational effect on the light as it leaves, and that in itself will cause a redshift. So you have to understand that the impact of the gravitational redshift. Also, the light waves, the reason that they're redshifted, the reason that the light waves get longer, is because space itself is expanding. So you imagine these light waves traveling along, and you stretch space, which is what this expansion really is, that's why the light waves get longer. So it's more complicated than I've explained, but at the end of the day, it's utterly compelling as the best way to explain why this, the best way to explain this expansion.
I'm just wondering, are there any theories that you're aware of that would account for the mass that would have been around at the beginning of the Big Bang? Like, how did that come to be? And are there existing theories out there that might explain why that is the case?
So where did that mass come from?
Yeah, hypothetically.
Where did that mass... So what came before the Big Bang? Is that the kind of thing... Okay, what came before the Big Bang? There are two usual ways people try and address the question, what came before the Big Bang? One way is to try and address it in words, and words are very vague. Another way to address it is... with mathematics, and mathematics is just very complex. What I've got is three diagrams, and for me, these three diagrams kind of give us a good understanding, just kind of sometimes pictures work very well. These three diagrams for me begin to address the question, what came before the Big Bang? So here are the three diagrams. First of all, there was nothing. Then it went foom. Then there was something, okay? let me run through that again. Unfortunately, nobody really knows. I mean, there is one argument that says there's negative gravitational potential energy and that kind of cancels out the mass energy. That still doesn't answer the question of why or how, what kickstarted this. But people do work on this problem. People, you know, the Perimeter Institute work on these kind of questions. What I would say is I think the Big Bang theory is true. You know, there's huge amounts of evidence that indicate and are compatible with and can only be explained in the context of the Big Bang theory. But the Big Bang theory has gaps. It has holes. It's not perfect. There are bits that people don't understand. And the biggest gap is what came before the Big Bang. And there we enter the area of speculation. One of the ideas, for example, is that before our universe, there was another universe. And that universe gave birth to us. And in turn, we may have daughter universes. So you have a whole family tree of universes. And each one of those universes is slightly different, just like children are different from their parents. So you have an infinite number of different universes, all of them different. And people like this idea of a multiverse, an infinitely variable multiverse. People like this idea because it could explain why there's life. Life is a remarkable thing. If you don't have just the right conditions, life can't exist. Even as things as fundamental as gravity. We have a certain force of gravity in our universe. If you drop an object, it falls at a certain rate because of big G, that gravitational constant. If big G was bigger, if gravity was stronger, then stars would collapse very quickly. They'd burn very quickly, and you wouldn't have time for life. So high gravity is bad. Low gravity is bad because then stars don't even form. So you've got to have just the right kind of gravity. There's only a small window that's compatible with life. Similarly, you've got to have just the right electric force, just the right nuclear forces, and so on. So how come everything is just right for life? Well, if you have an infinite number of universes and they're all different, well, some of them will be sterile, but some of them will have just the right conditions for life. And we happen to live in one of those because we couldn't live anywhere else. So it's a speculative idea, but it's one that people are sort of fond of. The question is, how would you ever prove this? And people say, well, I think Auguste Comte, the French philosopher, in the 1830s said there are some things we'll never, ever know. And number one on his list, he said, we will never, ever know what the stars are made of. And yet within 10 years of his death, we knew what stars are made of, using exactly this kind of stuff. So what seems impossible now, in 10 years' time, there may be sensible answers. The very first time I ever gave this talk was in Edinburgh. And the very first question I ever had was, what went bang? And the woman who asked that question turned out to be Neil Turok's old school teacher. Neil Turok's a very eminent cosmologist today. And so it was a very smart question from clearly a very smart woman who taught a really smart kid. And I explained to her about multiverses and so on. And then what I said to her was what St. Augustine said when he was asked the same question. St. Augustine was asked not what came before the Big Bang, but what was God doing before he created the universe? So what was God doing before he created the world? And St. Augustine thought for a second, so what was God doing before he created the world? He was creating hell for people who ask questions like you. So it's a very, very fair Thank question. You. Very fair question, but unfortunately we don't have any answers.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.